Hi, I'm Lucia.
And I'm Mel, and this is Totally Normal About That, a podcast where we explore various pieces of queer media and the things we love, hate, and love to hate about them. And this week, we're doing a special episode and feeling totally normal about vampires. Let's dive in.
Yes. We've obviously been doing several weeks covering different vampire pieces of media, and as we all know, vampires are super queer. But as we did more research into them and their history, I just was so surprised to see exactly how deep that really went, because it's so much more fundamental to who they are than even I think I realized. And it's so exciting for me to get to talk to you about this then and discuss all of their history.
I think we're coming at this from, like, a little bit different angles this week. Like, you've been doing a lot of reading on certain aspects of sort of vampirism and media and queerness. And I think I have more to perhaps contribute in the medical sort of area about vampires. So I think that it's going to be a lot of fun to see where these things overlap.
Absolutely. Well, I want to set us up a little bit with a couple details about the history of vampires in general, and then I'd love for you to expand on that with, like, what prompts, you know, some of the belief in vampires in general before we get into their place in media.
Absolutely.
I've loved vampires as a monster and as a concept for a really long time, but I have to attribute a lot of the information I have or the spark in my desire to learn more about the actual, like, history of the vampire movement, especially in America, to the Dollop podcast, because they did an episode called The American Vampire Panic. That was really great and had a lot of information in it. And some of the facts I'm bringing are coming from that and being sourced from there. So just so people know, if you want a more detailed story specifically about the history of vampires in the US, you should check out that episode.
Good recommendation. Also, if any of what you're saying is wrong, you can blame them.
Absolutely. Yes, totally their fault if any of these facts are incorrect. So I'm sure when we think of vampires, a lot of that comes from the idea of, like, the Eastern European beliefs, and we picture vampires, like, living in the, you know, castles in Transylvania and whatever, as, like, that original idea that kind of, like, was evoked in Dracula and, like, from Count Orlok and those, like, early tellings. And that's primarily because those beliefs did originate from Eastern European cultures and, like, came to the U.S. specifically from, like, Slavic immigrants. Originally, they weren't called vampires. Like, the idea of the creatures were other beings. For example, like, people believed in, like, the Striga, which is really more of, like, a witch, or, like, other concepts. But over time, it evolved to become the creature we now call vampire, which has become, like, a more universal idea that is, like, widely accepted.
Yeah, vampires in general are very Slavic. Like, that is sort of the realm of the world. Of course, there are different places in the world that have sort of their own mythos around vampires or bloodsuckers or things like that. But vampires, as tends to be understood in popular culture, is something that comes sort of from Slavic areas.
Yes. And the interesting thing about vampires is they're basically something that happens when there's a time of crisis in a community, and then a death or a dead body comes to the attention of that community and becomes the source of blame for the crisis. Mm-hmm. So basically we're looking for a reason for what is happening, and then they find one with any kind of unusual circumstances around a death, and then that deceased person becomes the vampire. And typically the source of crisis is a disease.
Yes. Yes, so there are a number of diseases that have been associated with vampirism. Plague, of course, is a big one. Because people didn't really understand how the plague spread. But also rabies is mm-hmm. really heavily associated with vampirism. Because, of course, people... when rabies spreads, it spreads through saliva. Mm-hmm. Or it can also spread through... You know, it spreads through bodily fluids. But, like, biting mm-hmm. is a big thing that happened. So rabies outbreaks have been... been associated with vampirism. And in particular, during the 18th century, there was a rabies outbreak in Europe during the middle of a big bout of vampire hysteria. So, like, that idea. Mm-hmm. And of course, rabies isn't just about biting. There's also things that go along with it, like insomnia and aversions to light and water. And obviously, mm-hmm. you know, most vampire lore has vampires as sort of being averse to sunlight, or, you know, not able to be in the sun and being up at night. So that's
right.
That's a big one. Although those aren't the only diseases that are necessarily, or conditions that are associated with vampirism that could have contributed to the sort of understanding of vampirism that we have.
Yeah, in around that same time that you mentioned rabies was the big kickoff in Europe, we also saw, again, the panic in the United States. It mostly took place in New England, but it was also, you know, in Western states as time passed and people obviously, like, moved further out west. I think it made it as far as, like, Minnesota. So, and over about a 100-year period, there were at least 80 recorded cases, and they think like a few hundred not recorded cases of bodies exhumed with the belief that, you know, they were dealing with vampires. Mm-hmm. And the primary disease cause for that in the U.S. was tuberculosis.
Yes, of course. Or consumption, as we mm-hmm. we used to call it. But yes, give me the vampire story about a vampire that lives in Minnesota and is just, like, a farmer.
Right. That was apparently part of it, too, was the fact that it was primarily people who lived in the country, because it wasn't really as big of a deal in the cities, but it was in rural areas in the U.S. that really saw these... beliefs in vampires thrive, and these investigations into vampires in the United States specifically. And part of the reason for that was obviously due to limited access to more advanced medical practices. You know, when you're living in very rural areas, there's obviously less people there. You know, there's less access to medical advances and education. But obviously you also have, like, more insular communities that are more, mm-hmm. you know, prone to developing, like, particular customs and practices that are limited, like, to those communities. And tuberculosis really ravaged families in the 1800s in the U.S. It was responsible for, like, I think 25% of the deaths in children under 5.
It's a lot.
Or, like, the death of 25% of children under 5, I should say. Mm-hmm. So, like, quite a number of people, and it would ravage entire families. It was something that really, like, they called it consumption because it basically, like, slowly wasted away people's bodies and, mm-hmm. You know, had this, like, hacking, bloody cough associated with it. Think like Sam Winchester during the demon trials, you know, literally coughing up blood and like slowly wasting away to nothing. Like he basically was, you know, a modern example of what TB looked like. And obviously we have like Doc Holliday from Tombstone and everything, you know, pale and flushed with a fever and dizzy and coughing, and it just it was really awful. And because it was, you know, something that was spread through, was an airborne illness, again, it was like shared amongst families who shared spaces. And when the first family member would die, people had this belief that that family member was like stealing the life from the rest of their relatives as they slowly died. But it wasn't helped by the fact that during this time there was a lot of relocation going on from the rural areas to cities. So there was a lot of like farmland and homes and everything that were being abandoned as people moved, which I think contributed to that sense of like creepiness and unease that people in those small communities were left with.
Right. And obviously, like, in general, especially during that sort of time, people in rural areas tended to be less educated. These were communities in which kids worked on the farm, and so, like, they wouldn't be going to school, and we didn't have the same sort of level of schooling that we do today. And so, like, if you don't have an explanation for something, like, you're going to come up with something. And also, you know, rural areas have a lot of bats. A lot of bats on the farm. Which could be where some of that association comes from. But there are...
Yeah, that's absolutely true.
A lot of others, too. So, like, one of the things that people may have thought was vampirism is a series of disorders called porphyria. There are a bunch of different kinds of them, but cutaneous porphyrias, basically, and porphyrias are... basically a group of disorders that result in impaired hemoglobin production, which can lead to anemia and an accumulation of porphyrins in the skin. And those are things that cause photosensitivity. And so people who have porphyria, specifically cutaneous porphyrias, can cause that can cause sensitivity to the sun and sometimes even other forms of light as well, and that can cause burning in the skin or blisters or fragile sort of thin pale skin, so like that for sure is something that people who had had those conditions at a time before we knew about them might have associated with vampirism. There's also some school of thought, although there are sort of varying opinions on this, that specifically ingestion of garlic has been associated with hemolytic anemia. And so potentially some people with porphyrias, a lot of garlic consumption could exacerbate their symptoms, which could be where we get the garlic connection of like why people... why vampires are supposedly garlic-verse. So that's one big reason for sort of this understanding of what vampires are. But it also just has to do, like, a lot of vampirism has to do with the way bodies decompose and are buried. And I'm... I could talk at length about that.
Well, before we go there, I just want to take a second to talk about what you mentioned regarding anemia, because vampire, like, most people may not be aware of this, but the actual history of the beliefs surrounding vampirism and the investigations of corpses believed to be vampires and everything are heavily associated with women. In fact, like, most of the cases in the U.S. That I read about were... women that were believed to be vampires and were blamed for being vampires. And there's a lot of reasons for that. And you know, misogyny is like heavily a part of that, and obviously the immune systems of women at that time and versus, you know, their diet and their roles as caretakers and everything would obviously lead to them being more likely to die sooner. Also their role in childbirth versus like the men of the family. So there's a lot of reasons why women might be the first to die and therefore the first to blame for being vampires. But anemia is just also something that's very common in women, like statistically more common in women than men, for a number of reasons. And again, you know, menstrual cycles, childbirth, all of that would have a part to play in that. But diet is also a huge part in that. And as you and I talked about on previous episodes, when we discussed some historical pieces of fiction, or some pieces of historical fiction, I guess, women often tended to have more meager diets and diets that include less meat, specifically like less red meat in their diet, which would be more likely to result in low iron, which is what contributes to anemia. And the symptoms of anemia are really fascinating because a lot of them like are associated with either vampirism or being the victim of a vampire. So like fatigue, dizziness, insomnia, chest pain, abnormal paleness, difficulty concentrating, hair loss, brittle nails, like all of those things are symptoms of anemia. And I can see where there are people who would look at that and say, like, oh, they could be a vampire. But it's also very likely that that's part of the reason why women were seen as being more likely victims of vampires than men.
Ah, misogyny.
So fun. But yeah, you mentioned another part of that is the way that bodies decompose. And as I mentioned, you know, when there is any kind of question about the decomposition of a body, or it's brought to the attention of the community, that can often result in that deceased person, that body becoming like believed to be the cause of the disease. It's notable that most of the diseases are passed along either through airborne means or through bodily fluids, because obviously people are now looking to handle these corpses even more, believing they're vampires, which means they're more likely to come into contact with these diseases. We know better now, but they didn't then. And do you want to go ahead and share some information about what all that entailed?
Let's talk about mortuary practices. So here's the thing about dead bodies, is they're weird, right?
Very much.
And they do kind of weird things. So when you die, your body does different things. When you die, the blood in your body pools where you lay. It slows down because it cools so much over time. So someone who is lying on their back for burial might look particularly pale because most of the blood in their body has pooled to their back. But some other things happen. A lot of people, there's this misconception that after you die, your hair and your nails keep growing. But that's not true. What happens is that your skin recedes. So you tend to get these really weird-looking nails. Your gums also recede, which makes your teeth look longer and sharper.
And they do that, again, because of the lack of blood flow and everything, right? Where it's essentially, like, pulling in, it's tightening up.
Yeah, basically, like, your body doesn't have fluid moving around. So, like, and there's no more, like, you lose a lot of water. But dead bodies also just do weird things, too. Like, mm-hmm. as they decompose, bodies make sounds. Bodies, mm-hmm. like, can groan or move a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Pressure that builds up decomposition can push blood into the mouth.
Well, that's sexy.
Right? Yeah, you just, like, you open a coffin and you just open the mouth and it's just blood.
Yeah.
Okay. And then also things like bloating occurs.
Yeah.
Skin can shed. Like, all of that kind of stuff is part of decomposition. And that's not all that happens. So part of it is the fact that bodies decompose very strangely. But bodies also, like, a lot of this is going to come from the way we bury bodies.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a time, and this happens particularly during times of plague or mm-hmm. Poverty. Mm-hmm. There's not enough room for graves. So plots in graveyards fill up. And then, well, what do? Instead of digging 6 feet under, they dig 2 feet under.
Well, that's not great.
And they add another layer of bodies. And they are, you know, this happened a lot sort of in the area around the end of the 17th century when there were a lot of plagues and things. There's just, like, a lot of dying going on.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, these bodies would just be dumped into pits.
Mm-hmm.
And most of them didn't have coffins. Those were luxuries. So they'd just be shrouded in cloth. And so, like, bodies would rise if there was a lot of rain and the ground got really wet. Maybe there were animals that could dig and get them up.
Mm-hmm.
This was just something that could happen. Like, bodies would just show up. There's actually an episode of the TV show Bones where there's a lot of heavy rainfall and a bunch of bodies sort of
just wash up.
Washed up. And, like, that's a thing that could happen. And so, like, that happens, and that people who don't understand science would be like, oh my god, these bodies dug themselves out of their graves. It's vampires. Mm-hmm. And when really it's right. just improperly observed burial rites.
Right.
And so this would cause even more panic. And again, like, if this is a time of, like, plague, bodies don't look great. And, like, decomposition can happen. It happens differently depending on the conditions. Like, mm-hmm. obviously corpses that aren't embalmed are going to decompose very differently than corpses that are.
Mm-hmm.
But it also has to do a lot with things like soil condition, climate,
mm-hmm.
the acidity of the soil, especially if you're not buried in a coffin, the temperature, like, all of that kind of stuff can impact rates of decomposition. And so you might get bodies and the time of year they're buried in.
Mm-hmm.
So you're going to get bodies washing up in various states of decomposition, and you might get some that look still kind of fresh.
Mm-hmm.
And that would freak people out really bad, but also more decomposed bodies would freak people out really bad. And that would lead to things like depictions of vampires like Nosferatu, where it looks like basically a body that has been dead for a long time, like withered away, desiccated.
Mm-hmm.
It's all really, yeah. really yummy stuff.
I mean, that's definitely a word for it. I don't know that I would use the word yummy to describe decomposing bodies.
Fascinating, perhaps.
What I personally find fascinating is the human psyche and the way people look at decomposition and disease and science and everything and turn it into this lore, because they don't have the knowledge and the science to explain it, but they still need some kind of explanation. It's both fascinating and concerning how quickly human beings can turn their lack of understanding about something into conspiracy theory. And essentially that is what vampirism is, you know, the beliefs behind it, is it is a long existing type of conspiracy theory that's ultimately turned into lore that, you know, we've incorporated into our modern storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't know. I find it quite fascinating. It's interesting because the idea of vampires also goes back, like, quite a way. I mentioned, you know, Dracula and Nosferatu earlier, and those are definitely, like, early tales of vampires from, like, you know, the late 1800s. And, you know, we've talked about Anne Rice's Interview with a Vampire. We, you know, talked about Twilight and all of those stories. But the tales of vampires that were actually written down, not just oral legends, go back quite a way, even farther than that.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the earliest ones were in, like, the late 1700s, for example. And most of them were, like, in poetry and then eventually found their way into short stories and eventually novels. One of the earliest stories of a vampire was in a poem called The Bride of Corinth. And an excerpt here that I will share, it just says, "From my grave to wander I am forced, still to seek the good long severed link, still to love the bridegroom I have lost, and the lifeblood of his heart to drink." Oof. So they didn't specifically call this woman a vampire in the poem, but it's clear they're evoking, like, you know, the idea of a vampire there in that depiction.
Yeah, I mean, the whole drinking the lifeblood of the heart is, like, that's pretty vampire right there.
Yep. So vampires really became a thing in modern storytelling in the early 1800s. I'm sure people are aware that there was the famous, like, summer party that Mary and Percy Shelley and Lord Byron and all the different people attended that ultimately, like, led to Mary Shelley writing the story Frankenstein. But it also resulted in another writer there creating the story called The Vampire, which was ultimately published in 1819. It was one of the first short stories that specifically wrote about vampires. And it was very quickly followed by another story published in late 1819 called The Black Vampire, which was the first American written story, and specifically features a vampire that leads slaves to rebellion. And it's believed that that story is reflective of, like, the Haitian Revolution, where, if, you know, people don't know mm-hmm. about that event or aren't aware of that, the Haitian Revolution was a revolution that was led primarily by black slaves in Haiti to obtain their freedom from France. And Haiti ultimately became the first free nation run by former slaves.
Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting. I didn't know about that story.
Yeah.
I mean, I knew about the Haitian, like, I knew about that, the revolution, but...
Yeah, and so it's one of those things where, you know, as I was researching vampire stories, I became so fascinated because almost immediately after their, you know, popping up in media, we see them used to not just tell the story of, like, vampires as creatures, but specifically as a way to talk about important social and political occurrences that were going on at the time. And it was first done with the Black vampire there, specifically speaking about the revolution in Haiti.
So what you're saying is that vampires have also, or have always been, associated with marginalized communities.
Absolutely. Yep. Wow. And it just continues through the entire 1800s, basically up until the creation of Dracula. Like, the vampire stories that came out were almost entirely associated with marginalized communities and the telling of their stories. So some of the examples of that, let me go through them here for our listeners. One of the earliest ones was called Wake Not the Dead by Ernst Rappau. I don't know how to say his name. I apologize. It's German. But it was written in 1823. So again, like, pretty early after the first couple of vampire stories were being published. This one is specifically another female vampire. And in this story, she was raised from the dead against her will by her husband. Essentially because he just wants to have sex with her. And so he's like, yeah, you died, but I'm not ready for that yet. So I'm going to bring you back.
Necrophilia, question mark?
Mm-hmm. And I read it. It's like a fascinating story. Because again, most of these are short stories that were published during the time. Dracula was one of the first vampire novels. So leading up to that, pretty much all of these are short stories. And this one is really fascinating because, again, the man is just unsatisfied that his wife is dead. So he brings her back in order to sleep with her, and then becomes horrified when she essentially is this vampiric creature who is killing people and, you know, is like, what have I done? I brought back this unholy creature. And she's basically like, I don't understand your problem with me being like this and killing a few people to survive. You had no problem crawling into my grave to fuck my corpse. So maybe you need to get over it.
Right. Like, have you considered that this is all your fault?
Which, like, girl, go off. For real.
Yeah. Seriously. Like, you could possibly consider that, like, if you hadn't been, if you couldn't keep your dick in your pants.
Right. But I think that it's a really interesting story, especially in the time that it was written, because, like you said, vampire stories are heavily associated with marginalized communities and their struggles. And this specific story really deals with the idea of women at that time being reduced to personal property owned by men and essentially as sex objects for men to use. And she's pushing back on that in this story, and kind of reversing his own horror and, you know, making him face his actions as someone who was willing to, you know, reduce her down to an object and treat her like property.
Yeah. Ew.
It makes me think a lot about, I know, again, I'm going back to Supernatural, I apologize. And you know, I know a lot of people have issues with this episode. But there's an episode in the early seasons where a guy basically brings his female best friend back from the dead as like a zombie because he was in love with her and she died and he couldn't let her go. And ultimately she kills him in the episode. And I understand why, and like a lot of people take issue with that episode because it feels very reductive of women that this man is like bringing this woman back because he believes he's in love with her and like can make this relationship work. And when I found this story, Wake Not the Dead, I was just like, oh, that episode is basically just this. Like, it's just this man who couldn't let this woman go and is basically like, nah, I'll just keep her for me. I can make her still love me. Like, yeah, so there's so much to be unpacked there.
Yikes. Yikes, men. Yikes.
Yeah, yikes, men, for sure. Okay.
Notice that in so many of these stories, it's a man trying. It's a man trying to do something to a woman.
Yeah, just no good at all.
Let's not.
Another one that's obviously very famous and maybe our listeners have heard of is called Carmilla, which was written and published in 1872 by Sheridan Le Fanu, who is an Irish writer. This one is definitely one of the more famous early vampire stories. It's not a novel, but it's probably like a novella. Like, it's closer to that than, I mean, like a traditional short story. But it's basically about this vampire who goes by the name Carmilla, who is brought into this home as like someone to be cared for, and ends up developing a very strong relationship with the young lady who lives there named Laura, and ultimately like seducing her. It's incredibly sapphic and basically known as like the lesbian vampire story. It's really wonderful. If you haven't read it, go read it. It's awesome. You'll love it. Again, and then these are all being written before Bram Stoker's Dracula was ever published. My favorite one that I found, and I could gush about this forever, is a story that was a very short story. It was written in 1885, and it's called Manor. And it is a story of these two young boys who live in these islands that are set between, like, these, a real group of islands that are set, like, between the coasts of, like, Scotland and Finland, I believe. And basically, they fall in love, and one of them goes off on a ship to do some work, and when the ship comes back into port, it crashes and he drowns. The one who drowns, his name is Manor. And his boyfriend, and I call him boyfriend because in the story, they are explicitly in love and, like, together. They don't use that word, but, like, they are together. So his boyfriend, Hars, is, like, devastated by his loss. And Manor keeps coming to him in the night and, like, visiting him, essentially. And Hars begins to, like, waste away. And his mother is like, look, we have to do something about this, because if we don't stop him from coming, you'll die. And Hars is basically like, there's nothing that can be done. I'm going to die. All I ask is that when that happens, that you bury me with him. And then he does, and they do. And, like, it's just a lot of the vampire stories that were written in this time, because of the time period and the content and the fact that they're, you know, kind of seen as, like, monstrous and taboo, tend to be, like, dark and gothic. And while this story is obviously, like, a little bit dark because it's dealing with the death of his loved one and everything, it's told in a way that's just really beautiful and sad and romantic. Like, it's not really dark or creepy at all, because there's not, like, a horror element to it at all. Like, Hars is not scared of what Manor is doing. He's not, like, repulsed by it. Even the mother, who is, like, concerned about her son wasting away, isn't, like, angry necessarily. She's just very sad at, like, the goings-on of what's happening. And it just really feels like this in particular is a story about grief, and, like, how grief can is something that can slowly cause you to, like, wither away if you cannot move on from it or heal from it.
Yeah.
It's hard, but like, it's very short. And if it's something that any of you are up for, I do recommend reading it because it is very beautiful. It's very beautifully told. And it is explicitly queer. Like, there's no beating around the bush. Like, these are two boys that are very much in love in the story. When I read it, initially I was a little bit surprised because I knew that queerness was something that was associated with vampires. And like, again, obviously we have Carmilla, which is very sapphic, but this is just, it's not even like the queerness is hidden under the guise of vampirism. Like, the vampirism is a result of their queer relationship because it's like, they could not let one another go. And so Manor became a vampire because he could not let his lover go. And I was like, okay, well, I need to know more about why this particular story is so gay.
Yeah, tell me everything.
So I am very much, like, again, a psychology and a history nerd. So as soon as I saw the name of the writer, I was like, oh, yes, that's exactly why this story is so gay. And it's because it was written by a German writer. His name is Karl Heinrich Ulrichs. Cool. And again, for anybody who doesn't know, this man is basically like the father of the modern LGBTQ rights movement. Just like one of my queer idols, truly. Like, so cool. He was a German lawyer and also a writer. And he basically is referred to as like one of the first out gay men in like world history.
Wow.
Because basically he was like, he just very early on in his life came out to his family and was like, nah, I'm gay. I'm not going to hide it. I'm not going to pretend to be anything else. And then went on to, basically help coin the ideas and terms that were used to describe sexual orientations and ultimately like help develop the idea of what sexual orientations are.
Love that.
Right? He also had words to describe like intersex people. He didn't just talk about like gay and lesbian people. He also had language for bisexuals and was like very inclusive in that. He lived from 1825 to 1895, and was a huge champion for gay rights. And basically was friends with a lot of early, like psychologists and other scientists who like ultimately developed the study of human sexuality.
Nice.
Yeah, very cool dude. So
yeah, seriously, and considering when he lived, like,
right, which it's one of those things too. And I mean, not to get like too off track of vampires, but I mean, we are currently living in a unfortunately like a renaissance of fascism right now, and this is something that very much became a thing. And I know that it's something that most people are aware of, but there's been a huge rise in the denial of the fact that fascists and Nazis, you know, 100 years ago were burning queer texts and sending queer people and trans people to concentration camps or imprisoning them or what have you. But that is very much the truth and a part of that history. And it's unfortunately becoming a part of history across the world again now, as globally, but like particularly here in the US, you know, there are movements to shut down and eradicate mm-hmm. the rights of queer and specifically trans people. And I think it's really important that part of what we do is just like educate ourselves about that stuff and become really aware.
Absolutely.
But I don't know.
Yeah.
It's just very meaningful to me that this man who was German and who like specifically led the movement in his home country for so long was one of the early pioneers of the movement. And it's notable then that like they tried to silence him like so early.
Right.
And he basically was like, nah, dude, I'm going to live my life. And we owe a lot of the things we understand about queerness now to him.
Mm-hmm.
So.
I'm glad we can talk about him then.
Me too. They actually celebrate his birthday as a holiday in a lot of German cities, which I think is super cool. I'm like, yeah.
That's cool.
Treat it as like
a
pride holiday. For anyone who's curious, it's August 28th. So next year we can celebrate or something.
I definitely for a second thought you meant like today was August 28th and I was about to be like, babe, no.
No, we're in October. No, his I meant his birthday if we want to have a little like first gay man party or something. Right, obviously yes. It wasn't the first, but you know, as a tease. Yes. Anyway, so obviously there's lots of other vampire stories and pieces of media that exist since this time, but those are some of the earliest. And then we are on this podcast obviously covering a lot of more modern pieces. But I'm curious just now, like, what you feel about some of the changes that we've seen from those early pieces of media that really center marginalized people to more modern stories that seem to focus primarily on having like men be centered as the vampires and kind of what that looks like.
Well, I think notably like one of the things to think about is the shift from vampires as sort of scary and monstrous to vampires as sexy and otherworldly.
Mm-hmm.
I think that there's something really interesting to dig into there about the idea of women as vampires being monstrous and predatory, and men as vampires as being sexy.
Yeah. And it's not like as common, like, today in modern media. We do see more women and stuff as characters that are vampires. But, I mean, for a while there, it was a lot of men we were seeing, and it's kind of even back out.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that's more due to our change of how we treat women in stories than it is because of a change in our perception of what vampires are over the last couple of decades.
Yeah, absolutely. I just think it's something to think about with like the sort of maybe inherent misogyny of these stories is something that I think is important to at least consider. In general, I think that like I feel like we just have less vampires that are sort of scary. Like,
mm-hmm.
They're scary because they're deadly, but And there's becoming a little bit of a resurgence of this too, right? Like, there's been a number of movies the last few years that center really, like, that are sort of more horror focused.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah,
that's definitely true.
To sort of romance focused. Like, we've had the new Nosferatu.
Mm-hmm.
Is for sure one that is, like, scurry. And there was one, like, a year or two ago, a couple years ago, that was sort of like a Dracula one that involved a boat.
And Sinners is like a horror movie, right?
Oh god, I was just gonna say, like, and we could talk about Sinners. Have you seen it yet?
I have not. So
okay,
I don't know anything about the story. I just know it's definitely a horror story, which I'm very excited to know more about.
Yeah. Oh, okay. The Last Voyage of the Demeter was
okay, yes.
Was a monster sort of one. But yes, Sinners, which is very much a horror movie, although it centers race as much more of a it gets back to race.
Mm-hmm.
And vampirism. And that stuff. So, like, go see Sinners. It's so good. I can't even.
Okay. Well, as someone who may not watch it because I'm terrible with horror, I like true horror movies. I do horror comedy really well, but, like, the actual scary stuff I struggle with. You wanna go over some of, like, the general details of it without being too spoilery?
So essentially, Sinners is set in 1932 in the Mississippi Delta. So,
okay.
In the South in 1932.
Mm-hmm.
And it stars Michael B. Jordan as sort of mm-hmm. criminal brothers, twin brothers. He plays both of them.
Mm-hmm.
Who return home there after working in Chicago for several years, and they create a juke joint for the local black community. So they're looking to make sort of music and dancing and drinking and gambling and all of that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And they sort of get their cousin involved, Sammy, who wants to be a guitarist. But Sammy's father is a pastor and says that blues music is sinful. But they basically recruit a bunch of black people from the area, as well as a couple of local Chinese people, to get involved and work at this
mm-hmm.
at this juke club, and they're gonna do this big opening. We meet these two men are named Smoke and Stack. Their names are actually Elijah and Elias, but they go by Smoke and Stack. And
okay.
There's a white passing girlfriend involved, or ex-girlfriend, who is biracial but passes as white. And we meet an Irish immigrant vampire named Remick, who stays with a couple who are Klansmen.
Ooh.
And he turns them into vampires. So it is the
okay.
opening night of this juke joint, and the vampires show up, and they're like, "Hi, we would like to come in and do a little dancey dance." And they're like, "No, you're white. This is for black people." But Mary, who is the ex-girlfriend who's white passing, goes to meet with the vampires, who they don't know are vampires yet, because they realize that they actually need the money, because all of the people who are there are using basically fake currency from plantations. And from their sort of local community. She's like, we need actual money. Like, you need real money. So she goes to talk to them, but gets turned into a vampire. She, because she knows everyone who's there, gets welcomed back in. And she seduces and then bites Stack, one of these men. And then Sammy and Smoke discover them. And she, you know, it turns into a big thing where you've got, they're trying to close this place. Everyone leaves. The vampires who are outside turn all of them. And it turns into this sort of fight for survival. And the vampires have this sort of hive mind. And so they do a lot of like dancing and singing outside. And Remix, this sort of main vampire's whole thing is like, you should join us because this offers you immortality and freedom from persecution and, a family. And this is also when we find out that the person who sold these people the barn they're using for this joint is the head of the local clan and was planning to come attack it at dawn anyway. And kill all of the black people in it.
Wow.
So there ends up being a big fight. And a few of them survive. And then all of the vampires are incinerated at the sunrise. Smoke, who thinks he's lost his brother to vampirism, sends Sammy home. And he then lies in wait for the clansmen and kills them, but is fatally shot. And Sammy decides to travel to Chicago to become a blues musician. And then there's sort of this great post-credit scene where it's 1992 and Stack and Mary, who survived and are still vampires, visit Sammy at a local blues club. And we find out that Stack was spared on the condition that Sammy live in peace forever. And then Sammy's like, I don't want to be a vampire, but I'll perform for you. And Sammy and Stack sort of reminisce about the fact that despite it being a night they're both haunted by, it was the greatest day of their life. And like the only time they were all truly free.
Interesting. Well, now I want to watch it.
You should watch it. The music is great. And it's like,
I mean, scary parts. I always want to. I don't know how I made it through Supernatural. I don't do horror well.
There are some scary parts, but it's so worth it. So thanks everybody for listening to me just rehash the entire plot of this movie.
Yeah. I'll have to try to check the timestamps and like put it in. Anyone who doesn't want spoiled for Sinners, skip this conversation. But like,
I will, when I edit,
I'm here for it. Make note or something.
I'll try to remember to make note of that.
We'll see what happens. Either way, we'll tell people. But yeah, no, I'm excited because I want to understand more about it. I like that that's something we're moving towards, though. I mean, again, vampires have long been like an allegory for queerness in media and something that allows us to talk about that angle. But honestly, I'm really excited for the idea that we're moving to a place where we can begin to again use vampires as an allegory for other marginalized experiences, and like race being one of them is really fascinating to me. And especially again after learning about some of the early stories and tellings of vampires, specifically the Black Vampire being, you know, a story about the Haitian Revolution. I love that this is kind of coming back around to again be used as a story about Black liberation versus like oppression by white people. I just think that's really cool. Like, I love it.
Yeah, and the way that they had the original vampire be an Irish immigrant is such a fascinating... Because he understood persecution as well.
Mm-hmm.
And his whole thing in the movie was like, I'm trying to find my people again. Like, I'm trying to build back up my family after losing them all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's really cool. And so I like knowing sure, that that's something we're doing.
For sure, a good watch.
Yeah, so I mean, obviously we talked about the early history of vampires and everything in media. And kind of the actual real life history and medical history that led to vampires becoming part of our modern lore. Are there any other big vampire stories that happened, say, within like the last 100 years or so, like as movies and TV became more of a thing, that you personally feel are like fundamental to our understanding of vampires in modern media?
I mean, obviously the original Nosferatu. Is a big one.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there were things like Van Helsing.
Mm-hmm.
Which I haven't actually seen, but I know that that's a big one. And, of course, there's stuff like Buffy.
Yeah.
That really, really popularized a lot of this stuff, but...
Right, like, obviously, how could it not?
Right, like, I think that there's a lot of... I don't know, I feel like the lore is something that's sort of built on itself. Like, a lot of vampire lore feels like it's been very yes and, the way it is in improv, where it's like, this is vampires, and...
Mm-hmm.
With fewer... With sort of major shifts towards the sexy, but then mm-hmm. also towards the sort of tormented. Like, we got the move to vampires that are, like, tortured by their own existence, which is a very Twilight thing. And I think we can't, you know, we've talked yeah. about Twilight, but we cannot ignore... the impact it had.
Yeah. I think for me, one of the things that really influenced vampire stories was the shift in making vampires accessible to kids and, like, mm-hmm. safe for children to watch. Because obviously we have a lot of the classic vampire stories that are told for adults. But when we started incorporating vampires into, like, you know, the Munsters or whatever, then now we've made it family friendly. Right. So it's something that kind of everybody can watch. And now we have, like, Hotel Transylvania, you know, which is a classic kids series of cartoon movies that I've watched countless times with my child, who loves them now. And it has this exposure to vampires and werewolves and Frankenstein and ghosts and all of these other things, that, you know, he might not have access to otherwise. And that obviously shapes, like, his idea of what vampires are and what they look like. And I just think that's a big change and a shift, because vampires can still be scary and there can still be horror attached to them. But I think it just, like, broadens the idea of, like, what they are and how we can access them and, like,
yeah, it's funny. It's funny you say that, because there was a movie that I watched growing up sometimes called The Little Vampire.
Yes. That was, I couldn't think of that one, but like, I was like, that's the one I loved as a kid. Like,
yeah. And I remember the first time I saw that, like, and I only saw part of it. Like, I don't remember where I was or why I was watching it, but I saw part of it and I remember like, oh my God.
I used to watch it all the time as a kid. I love it so much. It's got the kid from Jerry Maguire in it, and it's so good.
Yeah. That movie, and they, like, that did a lot for making vampires family-friendly.
Yes.
But also like now there's stuff like, you know, Bonicula and Vampirina. Like, all that stuff that's, like, kids' shows that are for vampires.
Yeah. And, like, again, and, like, I'm here for this. I'm not complaining about kids' stories being vamp. Like, again, I grew up watching The Little Vampire and, like, loved that stuff. And vampires existed in Goosebumps and everything for a long time. So, I mean, this shift to making them family-friendly is not new or limited to, like, my son's generation. I mean, it's been around for longer than I've been alive.
Right. Yeah, there was a book series that I read growing up, The Bailey School Kids. And the first one in that series is called Vampires Don't Wear Polka Dots.
Yes. Yes, so. I remember those. And I love that because then it allows you to view vampires through a variety of different lenses. Like, you can choose them to be horror, but you can also use those stories for comedic purposes. You know, vampires can be used to tell us the stories of the horrors of racism or sexism or homophobia or whatever, but they can also be used to highlight the silly misconceptions that people have about just like common everyday things and the way that life works, and, you know, the over dramatic misinterpretations that children have about stuff going on in people's lives. I also like that we've just gotten additional, like, horror comedies in general, like that's something that's really become more and more of a thing, because again, I struggle a little bit with horror when it's like genuinely intended to be scary, but when it's like horror comedy, I'm definitely a lot better with it and a lot more here for it. So like Renfield, for example, I know that had mixed reception because obviously, like, it's a very bloody comedy horror. But I, like, love that movie. Like, I think it's fantastic. So, like, I appreciate that we've reached a point where we're willing to go that direction.
Yeah. Absolutely.
It's very fun for me, I'm just going to say.
Yeah, I mean, I think that one of the things that gives vampires the staying power that they have is that there are so many different variations that all build off of that common sort of theme.
Yes, absolutely.
Like, there's a vampire for everybody.
I also think, and this is something that we talked about a little bit with Mary in our last episode where we discussed What We Do in the Shadows, but, you know, bringing up Renfield is a good reminder that part of the lore of vampires that has slowly been incorporated through the stories is the idea that vampires have some kind of familiar or servant or someone there to essentially serve their needs. And so it opens up other aspects of the story beyond just like the horror of the specific vampire nature, to also delve into this idea of like an intermediary for them as someone who is finding people to sacrifice to the vampire, and it, you know, is protecting them from being harmed and hunted and whatever. And like, there's the master servant relationship part of that, but there's also just this idea of like, what is more horrific, a vampire who kills people to feed, which is just that vampire meeting its needs, or a person who is human, who is intentionally like selecting and feeding people to this monster, and like the horror of like that intentionality and that choice being made. I kind of love that that is something that like people can dig into. Like, it's a, there's just so much there that you can just examine.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think, yeah, one of the, like, vampires, there's just so much there.
Right. That's the best thing about, like, you know, monster stories in general, is when you take it out of the reality of it, you know, when you step away from, like, the historical reality of there were people who believed that their dead relatives were coming back and, like, preying on them, and you take it to a more fictional literary place and say, okay, we're separating what we're talking about from the reality and looking at it through a fictional lens, through a metaphorical or an allegorical lens, and viewing it then as like lessons and an interpretation of human behavior, and saying, what does this mean for us as people and as like a society? I love what monster stories allow for us then to do, and the way it allows us to understand ourselves better as people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. Monsters are fun. Monsters are fun, and they're, yeah, they're really important because there's this thing called the uncanny.
Mm-hmm.
Are you familiar with the uncanny?
Like Uncanny Valley?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. So basically, like, the Uncanny Valley, for people who might not be familiar, is this idea where something that's near human causes this feeling of eeriness.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an interesting, like, it's an interesting phenomenon, but it also is an interesting tool that is used in media to help us sort of explore otherness.
Mm-hmm.
In new ways, and monsters like vampires really fall into that. Like, I took an entire class about it in college, basically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I've always really, really loved that. And, I mean, I personally enjoy when shows and movies and even books are willing to go the, you know, full monster vibes and, like, really make their monsters and creatures and whatever fully inhuman, because that is always a fun thing to explore. But also, like, I have a softness for these near-human monsters and creatures. And vampires are an interesting one because they always fall in that near-human. Like, yeah. The furthest away is someone like Nosferatu, who is basically a decrepit corpse. But, like, essentially because they all start as human, they stay fairly human because vampires are not that different. And so, like, part of the fascination then is, you know, how they could exist among us and whatever and yet be so different. Whereas a lot of other monsters and creatures are like, what separates them tends to be that they are only sometimes monsters, or monsters under certain mm-hmm. conditions or whatever, like werewolves shift under the moon and whatever, but like Like, vampires are vampires all the time.
Right.
So, there's something unique about them that I just find very fascinating.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, all that to say...
Do you have any other feelings about vampires or vampire media that we should mention?
I mean, I have all the feelings about all the vampire media, and I'm very excited to finally get to other pieces of media that we haven't gotten to yet. But I think for now, we're going to, you know, wrap up our conversation on vampires here for a while and move on to some other things for the rest of the year. And then... who knows? Maybe next year we'll come back and we'll talk about vampires more.
I feel that we have a few listeners who would be extremely upset if we did not, so...
Yeah. I can definitely think of at least one who will not give us any peace until we get through at least some additional pieces of the same person. Vampire media. We love you, Lyra.
Yeah.
Anyway, so. Yeah. We will get to other things, and I'm very excited to do that. But I think for now, we're going to wrap up Vampire Fall, and we are going to move into some other discussions. Because, hey, guess what? You know, I mentioned Supernatural a couple times, and we know, if you know us, you know that we love it. And this upcoming month is November. And
oh my god, what?
It is Wednesdays. Seriously, what? Are the 5-year anniversaries for the last few episodes of... the entire run of Supernatural. And so we figured, what better way to commiserate of our feelings of the, you know, ending of Supernatural than by going back and having some anniversary discussions on those episodes. So next week, next Wednesday, is going to be November 5th. And we felt like it's been 5 years, so it is the perfect time for us to come back and talk about the season 15, episode 18, confession anniversary and all of its glory. And if you have feelings about it, you should join us.
Yes, absolutely. Please come yell at us about it.
Yeah. And then we'll continue on from there. So... we'll be sharing all of our feelings about that and all the other things associated with it. If you missed it, we already had quite a discussion for the 20th anniversary about the legacy of the show and Castiel and his role in the show. But we couldn't let this particular anniversary pass us by without having at least some kind of conversation about what it means for us. So here we go.
We'll see you all next time.
Bye.
Bye.
Totally Normal About That is a podcast hosted and produced by Lucia and Mel. Are you feeling totally normal about something we talked about today? Is there a piece of media you feel totally normal about? We want to hear about it. You can find us on Twitter at @totallynormalat, or you can email us at totallynormalaboutthat@gmail.com. And if you are enjoying these episodes, please leave us a rating and review on your podcast.